The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to the Navigating Your Life Show, featuring host Dr. Nathaniel J. Williams. In the next hour, the goal of the show is to help you with the challenges facing you and potentially change your life forever. Now here's Dr. Nathaniel J. Williams.
Well, good morning, and thank you so much for joining our show today. We're going to be spending some time talking about the bipolar 2 disorder with a person by the name of Susan Shelley, and I will introduce her in a minute, but I just wanted to highlight the importance of our conversation today because it deals with making sure that we have an inclusive society and that every person with their strengths as well as their challenges finds a home and a comfortable home within our communities. And one of the things that Susan talks about is that in our society that we find it more acceptable to be an alcoholic or a drug addict as opposed to a person who has some mental health challenges. And that stigma is a major challenge. And in my work with individuals with mental retardation and other developmental disabilities, again, the level of stigma that they have to endure presents some real challenges for them to have an everyday life like everybody else. So this is so important of a topic that we have today to talk about. So we want to make sure that we do justice to that. So without further ado, we're going to have Susan Shelley join us. Good morning, Susan. How are you?
Good morning, Dr. Williams. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And Susan, in just reading a little bit about your bio, it says that you've lived with a mental illness over a decade and that you have done some what I call heavy lifting over the last couple of years fully understand what your illness means and how it has affected your life. So first of all, one of the things I want to clarify, should we call it an illness or a challenge? What is a way that you would find most appropriate to title what you contend with?
Most definitely, bipolar disorder is an illness.
Okay. All right. So why don't you tell us, and I see in your bio that you call it a bipolar 2 disorder. For those of our listeners who may just not be aware of what that all entails, what is the difference between a bipolar disorder 1, 2? Just help us understand some of that background, if you don't mind.
Certainly. When people think about the term bipolar disorder, I think the general imagery is one of severe mania, people acting out and gambling and whatnot, and cycling to severe depression. Bipolar 2 disorder is more of what we refer to as hypomania. That is the distinguishing characteristic of bipolar 2. The DSM code distinguishes bipolar 2 disorder by looking at the length of time that the symptoms are present and the severity of the symptoms, how they affect one's life, their ability to function in their life. And bipolar 2 disorder, the hypomania bipolar 2 disorder, is very difficult to diagnose.
And you mentioned the DSM, and that's like a manual that psychologists and psychiatrists and other counseling and therapeutic professionals use to try to figure out what are some of the issues that a person's contending with. So I just want to clarify that for our listeners. So would you mind, Susan, sharing with us a little bit about what your story and your journey has been as you've contended with this illness?
Certainly. Mental illness, generally, you'll find when a person's diagnosed with mental illness, there is a family history of mental illness. And for me, this is very true. My family, unfortunately, many members are dealing with this illness on a daily basis, and we've lost three members to suicide as a result.
Wow.
So for me, this is something that I grew up with. I have
Let me interrupt you for a minute there. Would you say that that situation where you have so many in a family, is that what you consider the norm, or is that the exception rather than the rule?
I honestly don't know.
Okay. But just to
I think, unfortunately, because of the stigma surrounding mental illness, if it is present in families, they're not willing to discuss it.
Okay.
So there's a lot of, you may hear people saying, well, there was always something wrong with Uncle Charlie, but we never quite knew what it was. They're not going to come out and share that information.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So I'm sorry, I cut you off. Please continue.
That's okay.
You're sorry.
So I grew up with a family member who was greatly affected with mental illness, and much more extreme. It was bipolar 1 disorder. So I witnessed the extreme mania and gambling and acting out and the extreme depression. And growing up in that environment is not much different than growing up in an environment where you have an active alcoholic. There's a lot of uncertainty. You spend a lot of time being very hypervigilant about your behavior and what's going on in the house. You come out of that situation with a lot of coping skills that don't necessarily work when you come into your adulthood. So I've being raised in a situation of mental illness, when my mental illness started to show itself, I wasn't very ready to accept that that's what was going on. And I wasn't quite sure if the problems I was having in my life were a result of where I came from or coming from within me. And I come from an alcoholic family system. I come from a mental health, mental illness family system. So I spent a lot of my early years in counseling trying to decipher that. The ACOA family system has very clear behavioral roles of children when they come out of it, the responsible child, the family scapegoat, the clown, and I was a responsible child. And so I spent my first years in counseling understanding what that meant in my life, not even looking at the possibility of a mental illness. My illness, I really didn't even see my illness until after I went through a divorce in 1996, and that's really when it showed itself to the point where it could no longer be ignored.
And what did you find in dealing with people in your life? Did they see the problem? Did they help you to resolve it? Or was it somewhat of a isolated journey in trying to contend with it using the 1997 situation?
Well, unfortunately, at that point in my life, I found myself very isolated. One of the coping skills that I developed as a child to deal with my life was that I would escape into fantasy, and I spent most of my life feeling like I wanted to be someone else, doing something else, somewhere else.
Wow.
And the marriage that I entered into was probably the greatest escape that I ever chose. I am Scotch-Irish by birth, and I chose a partner who was Jewish, and I went down to the Bronx, and I jumped into a mikveh, and I converted to Judaism, and spent the next 10 years of my life playing this part that wasn't really me.
Wow.
And when you're not being your authentic self, you don't create authentic relationships. So when marriage ended, unfortunately for me, my identity walked right out the door, and I found myself very alone. My mother, even at that point, who had been dealing with mental illness with my father and various other family members that she had helped, wasn't able to really see what I needed. And I didn't understand what I needed. At the time, I was in therapy, and the most prominent problem I was having was one of anxiety. And so that's what they treated. And they treated that with Paxil. And if you put a person who is bipolar on Paxil or Prozac, you're going to force them right into a state of mania, which is what happened with me. And I was on Paxil for 3 years. So there weren't many people in my life who knew how to help me. And I wasn't even clear about what type of help I needed.
And so, Susan, there are some medications that may be dispensed to a person who has bipolar that, when you look at it on the surface, may be thought to be something good because it's treating maybe some of the ancillary symptoms, but may actually make things worse. So sometimes when people say, well, make sure they're taking their medication, I think you would add to that is make sure they're taking the right medication, because that may be a contributing problem as well.
Absolutely. Bipolar 2 disorder generally goes misdiagnosed for an average of 10 years. And the reason that happens is a lot of the symptoms of hypomania present themselves as other illnesses, possibly ADD, OCD, anxiety. At one point, I was treated for ADD and put on Ritalin, which was even worse because some of the symptoms of hypomania are racing thoughts, intrusive thoughts, flights of idea. And if I present in my therapist's office and that's all I'm sharing, they're going to treat the obvious. And if someone comes into an office in a depression, then they're going to treat the depression. And unfortunately, what happens is they'll come in, they'll discuss that they're having a depression, they'll look for treatment. Usually it's in the form of a medication. Hypomania will start to present, and they'll think that it's just their depression lifting, and they'll stop treatment. So in order for this to be diagnosed properly, there needs to be a continuation of treatment so that patterns can be acknowledged. And in most cases, that does not happen.
So in your situation, Susan, how did you get the help that you needed? When did things start to fall into place for you?
I was always in some sort of therapeutic setting, and I was properly diagnosed in 2001, and that came from a therapist that I had been in continual treatment with for almost 7 years, on and off. And she was finally able to, there was a lot of life events that were happening as a result of my poor choices, and she at some point decided that this was not happening from situational inside, this was happening from the inside out, and asked me to go for an assessment, which I did. And I went to see a psychiatrist, and they did the diagnostic through various questioning and decided that I was bipolar, which I didn't want to be because that's what my father was.
Hmm.
And that was what my understanding of the illness was. And like we hear a lot of alcoholics say, you know, I'm not going to be like Dad, or I'm not going to be like my parents. And in the end, that's exactly what happened. So I really fought it, and I didn't. And that's all the information they gave me, was that you're bipolar. And they switched my medication. I left there truly with no understanding of what that meant.
As we get ready to go toward our break, and we'll come back and continue our conversation with Susan Shelley, who's talking with us today about the bipolar 2 disorder. Shelley, if you had, I looked at your website, and I think I know the answer to this, but if you had something to suggest to a person in a very short period of time that they need to do as the first step in part of their recovery, what would you say that is?
Make a commitment to treatment. Make a commitment to have a continual relationship with a therapist.
Okay, as we get ready to go to our break, that's a wonderful piece of information, and I think, Susan, to get some help is truly the key. So when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Susan Shelley.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
Hyperbike Performance Centers, the extreme motorcycle tuning facility for performance-minded riders. For the most advanced tuning possible, bring your bike in for a diagnostic in their climate-controlled dyno room. Take advantage of their suspension services designed to tweak your bike's suspension till it fits your personal riding needs. All of their performance products are tested in their facility first. Brakes, wheels, alarms, GPS, and more. Hyperbike Performance Centers on Route 40 West, Frederick, or visit hyperbikeperformancecenters.com.
Wielding power, shaping environments and outcomes, and making things happen are all essential characteristics of great leaders. Yet these qualities alone are not enough to ensure your success. In a complex world, how do you decide what's most important to you? In your career, your relationships, your finances, your family, in the world around you, in the whole of your life at large? Dr. Joseph Riggio, the host of Leadership Intuition, says that personal leadership, the desire to take charge of your life, is the key to creating futures that work and building a life worth living. Join Joseph as he reveals the power of uncovering and living your own personal mythology, the key to personal transformation, exquisite performance, and social influence. Learn to look inside and discover your personal mythology and unique leadership style. Go beyond conventional advice and discover your unique success blueprint on Leadership Intuitions with Dr. Joseph Riggio each Friday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern on the Voice America channel. Leadership Intuitions, power, achievement, relationships.
Hey, Dad.
What?
I can't get the ketchup bottle open.
Here, let me try. Here you go.
Thanks.
You don't have to be a hero to be a hero. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To learn more, call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt U.S. Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your questions. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Tuned in to the Navigating Your Life Show with Dr. Nathaniel J. Williams. To participate in our discussion, please call 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to host@navigatingyourlifeshow.net. Now, back to the program.
Well, welcome back. We're spending some time today with Susan Shelley, who was talking with us about the bipolar 2 disorder and some things that she has learned through her journey with the illness. We were talking in the first break, before the first break, about stigma and a little bit about what the bipolar disorder looks like. And so often, sometimes, that it is misdiagnosed. And some things that we can do to try to avoid that. And just before the break, Susan was saying it's that it was important to begin the journey to get some help and to make sure that you reach out depend on some others to help you through that process. And we'll revisit this again at the end of the show, Susan, but other than a therapist, are there other groups out there that are helping individuals with mental illness to make their situation and their lives better? And what are some of their names and of those groups?
Yeah, there are several support groups out there that are available. Unfortunately, I'm not familiar with them right off the top of my head. If you go to the webpage, I have them listed under resources. There's a Depression's Anonymous group. There are many organizations online that you can go to. To look for support and others who are. I know NAMI is one of the most nationally well-known organizations, and that's NAMI.
You know what that stands for?
Yeah, it's the National Association of Mental Illness.
Okay.
And they provide a lot of family education courses and support groups, and they do a lot throughout the country to try to put an end to stigma.
Good.
And to get the word out there and help people.
And if any of our listeners would like to look at Susan's website, it's www.thenyoustand.org. So thenyoustand.org. So thenyoustand.org. And I was looking at that just before the show, and there's some really, really good information there. And as she said, just said, she has some information about herself, some frequently asked questions and comments and resources and how to contact her and meditation and the importance of that. So please take advantage of that. We have a caller before we get into talking further about the stressors that sometimes precipitate an illness. We have a caller, Elaine from Connecticut. Elaine, are you there?
Yes.
So please, Elaine, Susan's on the line. Would you pose your question?
Sure. I just have a quick question. If an individual has been diagnosed with bipolar, how would you explain hallucinations? Is that something that kind of goes along with that, or is it something in addition to the bipolar?
Oftentimes, if someone's suffering for bipolar 1, the psychotic break is something that will happen during an extreme manic episode. So it is inclusive in schizophrenia-type behavior and symptoms can be associated with bipolar 1.
And you talked in your written document about the stressors that sometimes bring out the illness and some of these behaviors. What are some of those stressors, Susan?
Death or divorce, coming from a dysfunctional family life, living in poverty, anxiety, anger, and loneliness, substance abuse by a person's parent. And a lot of these things are things that happen in everyday life, and it doesn't necessarily mean if you're coming from that environment that you will have a mental illness. But if you're susceptible to a mental illness, stress is the key trigger for an illness to manifest itself. And so, unfortunately, if you do have bipolar, your ability to handle stress is greatly diminished, and something that somebody else may be able to just, you know, pull their bootstraps up and move forward could cause us to just stay in bed. I know when my illness really came full force at me, I couldn't even get out of bed. I could barely function, and there was a woman that worked in the same facility that I did who was dealing with cancer, and she would go for treatment and go to work, and for me, I could just barely get out of bed. And other people looking in would say, you know, well, why are you so greatly affected by this? But unfortunately, that's what happens. Wow. So if you're susceptible to a mental illness, these types of life events can bring that out.
So reality is, you know, for some individuals, these events happen, as you said, they, you know, prepare themselves, they do what they need to do, and they move on. But for some other people, these things can truly be debilitating kinds of events for them and causes some major challenges. And when they seek some help, there is a book that's called the DSM, which is a manual that is used for people who are trying to work with others and trying to figure out what their challenges are. What does that book do to help a therapist or a counselor or a medical professional? What does it do to help figure out what the circumstances is? Is that a tool that does more good, or is it sometimes used in a way that causes some challenges?
Well, the DSM is a very concrete jumping-off point. It needs to be generalized so that anyone looking at the symptoms, as everyone's looking at the same symptom. But it doesn't nearly begin to address really what's going on. What's happening now in practice, psychiatrists and therapists are starting to see bipolar in more of a spectrum model. The DSM code is very concrete. You must have these particular symptoms for this particular period of time. Like for hypomania, they state that symptoms must be present for 4 days. Either an elevated expansive mood or being irritable. With additional symptoms that they list, there's probably 7 different symptoms that they list. But what if you only have them for 3 days? Are you not hypomanic? And so now they're starting to look at bipolar disorder more of a spectrum model, although the DSM code is not doing that. On the one end would be, excuse me, dysthymia, which is just being generally in a bad mood, to the other end, which is the bipolar 1 and the psychosis. And in any given point along that spectrum, your symptoms are going to change. And so hypomania and bipolar 2 were somewhat in the middle of that. And now that you'll hear the term, you know, level of bipolarity. It's not as black and white as it once was.
And so when you look at the issue of depression, which is something that is normally setting in when a person has a challenge, how is it different, or is it different type of depression for a person with bipolar 2 disorder, or is it pretty much the same as anyone dealing with a mental challenge?
Now, depression is generally consistent. The depression that you find with bipolar 2 is the same as that you'll find with bipolar 1. And actually, if you have bipolar 2, you probably will have more depressive episodes. So that the criterion to be diagnosed with depression is indeed the same.
And some of the other kinds of symptoms that you see, I think I remember seeing that you may have, where you ruminate on things and you have suicidal ideations. Could you talk a little bit about some of those other symptoms?
Yeah, the general belief about depression is that people are lethargic and they can't get out of bed and they can't, they're just not interested. There's a lot of commercials out now being put out by the pharmaceutical companies, and they talk about depression on a surface level. When I talk about depression, when I speak with grad students, I like to break it down into two different schools, one being the thoughts that are associated with depression and the other being the behaviors that are associated with depression. And the thoughts that are associated with depression, for me, at times kind of roll themselves into one large symptom. There are six different symptoms. The first for me being ruminating on excessive guilt. And what that looks like is if you were to take every embarrassing or painful thing that you've ever done in your life, put it on a videotape and just run it 24/7. It's like taking a whip to yourself. And you start to have what's known as catastrophic ideas. The littlest infraction that you feel that you may have done becomes huge. I remember there were times when I would go into my therapist's office and I would say, you would think I murdered someone the way that I'm responding to this, but this is how I feel. And then you have ideas of reference where it's a rather narcissistic view of your relationships with others. You're certainly convinced that they are very aware of what you're doing and that they're aware of how you're feeling and that their actions and their words all somehow have something to do with you. So for me, when those three things happen concurrently, I'm ruminating on a behavior that I may be embarrassed about, something that I feel I may have done wrong. I know that you're thinking about it. I know that the first time that I see you again, that's what you're going to see in me, and I'm catastrophizing it. So I'm in this heightened state of anxiety over something that someone else would have probably forgotten about 5 minutes later.
And when you're dealing with other people, how well have you experienced people tolerating all of this, all of these behaviors and issues and dynamics going on at a given time? Do you find that people stay with you or find a way to vacate your presence?
If they're dealing with these symptoms at the time that they're interacting?
They're dealing with you as you're dealing with these symptoms. Do you find people can hang in there?
They don't know what's happening. This is one of the problems. I often say, thank God there's not a speech bubble above my head as I'm interacting with you. Because you'll say to me, how are you doing today? And I'll say, fine. But what I'm feeling is I really feel like dying right now. So when people are suffering a depression, and when I speak with people about bipolar disease, if they come to me, because I am very outspoken about it, and so if someone's diagnosed with the illness, they'll come to me oftentimes and ask me about it. And I'll ask them, well, what are your symptoms? And they're not able to identify them. They're not able to put the word ruminating to what it is that they're doing. They don't understand that the fact that they're catastrophizing is indeed a symptom of their depression.
And so as we get ready to go for our next break, one of the things that I understand you're able to do is to make sense out of their situation. We'll talk further about that.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
What's it like?
What's it like?
It's lonely.
It's really lonely.
I miss my brother.
I miss my brother.
I'm surrounded by other people, but it's not the same.
I've got other people around me, but it's not the same.
It's pretty scary, but I don't let it rattle me.
It's scary around here, but I don't let it rattle me.
You always have to watch your back.
There's no one to watch my back.
I spend my whole day worried who's out to get me.
I'm always wondering who's out to get me.
But I can take care of myself.
But I can take care of myself.
No matter what, I'll keep my head up.
No matter what, I'll keep my head up.
It's not like I have a choice.
It's not like I have a choice.
This'll all be over in 5 years, 3 months, and 17 days.
This'll all be over in 5 years, 3 months, and 17 days.
Go to jail for a gun crime and your family serves a sentence with you. Something to think about before committing a gun crime. Gun crimes hit home. This message brought to you by Project Safe Neighborhoods and the Ad Council.
Hyperbike Performance Centers, the extreme motorcycle tuning facility for performance-minded riders. For the most advanced tuning possible, bring your bike in for a diagnostic in their climate-controlled dyno room. Take advantage of their suspension services designed to tweak your bike's suspension till it fits your personal riding needs. All of their performance products are tested in their facility first. Brakes, wheels, alarms, GPS, and more. Hyperbike Performance Centers on Route 40 West, Frederick, or visit hyperbikeperformancecenters.com.
Is there truly a lesson in every situation? Can you learn from another person's experiences, or are lessons learned when they only happen to you? Dave Pelzer, number one national and number one international best-selling author, challenges listeners to stand tall, to be accountable no matter what the setbacks, and to recommit to enhancing their lives as well as assisting others around them. Listen to the Dave Pelzer Show every Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Radio Network.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com. Tuned in to the Navigating Your Life Show with Dr. Nathaniel J. Williams. To participate in our discussion, please call 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to host@navigatingyourlifeshow.net. Now, back to the program.
Well, welcome back. We have with us an outstanding guest today in the person of Susan Shelley, who's talking with us about the bipolar 2 disorder. And Susan, we were talking a little bit about some of the symptoms and some of the circumstances that people contend with when they're going through a cycle with their bipolar disorder. And one of the things you wanted to highlight was to talk about was some of the suicidal ideations. You can pick up at that point. I would appreciate that.
Certainly. People who are dealing with major depressive episodes generally will at some point have an attempted suicide. With hypomania and with bipolar 2 disorder, what's more likely to happen is what's called suicidal ideations, and that's something that I began dealing with in my 20s. The onset of bipolar 2 disorder is said to be in your early 20s, and as I went through the process several years ago of really looking at my illness, I look back and I realize that that's exactly when it started for me. I was 23 years old and I was first married, and I was having a horrible time with ruminating, and I just could not stop it. And what accompanied that was just these thoughts of death, and for me, they came in the form of a vision. And this is difficult to share because people, you know, step back and think, my gosh, how could you do that? But I could envision myself hanging. And I can envision I'll have just this very fleeting thought of a gun or something that would just cause harm to myself. And it's, for me, what it is it's, I could be having a conversation with you and there could be a pause in the conversation and this thought will just come through my mind, or I'd be driving down the street and again, and this thought is there. There's no plan. There's never a plan. It's just like this muddy water of the thought of death. I'm overwhelmed, I'm tired, I don't want to do this anymore, I just want to check out.
Wow. So you have a situation where you're almost tired of being tired.
Yeah.
We have a caller, Terry from Florida, so let's hear what Terry's thoughts or comments are. Terry, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful. Thanks for calling in. And you have a question for Susan.
Yes, Susan. I'm interested in knowing if there's a correlation with bipolar to environmental or genetic.
Oh, absolutely genetic. Absolutely genetic. Bipolar is a brain-based disorder, and the environmental connection would be...
One second. Terry, are you questioning whether or not, my wife and I have a son with autism, and one of the things that they believe is sometimes that there is an influence of the environment. Are you saying that are there any chemical or environmental or other kinds of, I say chemical outside the body, not inside the body, kinds of influences? Is that what you mean by environmental?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So, and your answer is that it's more genetic than it is environmental, Susan?
Yeah, it would be my belief that no environmental factor can then cause bipolar in somebody, that it is, rather, it would be a dormant illness that is brought out by environmental factors.
Okay.
But I don't think that it could cause the illness itself.
Wow. Well, we have another caller. Thank you, Terry, for calling in. We have Carol from New York. Carol, do you have a question or comment for Susan?
Yes, I do. With all the medications for bipolar and their side effects, are there any alternative remedies?
Well, unfortunately, the research shows that herbs and whatnot can exasperate the symptoms. For me personally, my choice of managing my illness is threefold. It's medication, working a 12-step program because I am duly diagnosed, and continued treatment. But as far as any other herbs and whatnot, if that's what you're referring to, I'm not aware of any.
Okay, Susan, we have another caller. We have another caller from Ohio, and his name is Bob. Bob, please share your question or comment for Susan.
If a parent is diagnosed with bipolar disorder, are the children at risk for the same diagnosis as well?
I believe that they are, yes, and research does show that. For generally what happens if you have a son, if they are going to be at risk for it, and it's not necessarily guaranteed that they will develop the illness, but they will probably develop bipolar 1. For the female, it's generally bipolar 2.
Well, thank you.
And that's one of the things that when you go in for treatment, they're going to begin by taking a family history, because that is an indicator.
Okay. Well, we thank our callers for calling in. We have one more caller, Susanna from Chicago, and then we'll get back to some of the questions for you, Susan. So, Susanna, please share your question for Susan. Susanna, if you could talk a little louder, it's hard to hear you.
I often hear when people are dealing with mental illness that sometimes they go through a period where they're misdiagnosed initially, sometimes for a very long period of time before actually getting the correct diagnosis. So I'm wondering, is there anything that someone who's dealing with these issues can do, maybe when selecting a provider, to help to avoid these years of misdiagnosis and help get the answer correct in the first place?
That is a very good question. Unfortunately, with mental illness, there's no direct testing we can do to see what the exact illness is. And those who are there to help us need to rely on our ability to go in and verbalize our symptoms. So they can only deal with what we bring to them, and that's generally one of the main reasons there's a misdiagnosis. Someone, especially in a hypomanic episode, is not going to walk into a doctor's office and say, gee, I feel great, and I'm getting so much done, and I just got a promotion, when that could very well be part of hypomania. So if we don't know what to bring to the office and what to ask for help for, they have a difficult time, and that's why, especially with bipolar 2, it does take several misdiagnoses before we can get down to it.
And I guess with your work in speaking and trying to educate people, Susan, that's an effort to try to understand that there's so much on the landscape. It could be so many different issues, and you want us to have an understanding of these grad students and medical students of all that's out there so that they have more in their arsenal and they're aware of that. We watch enough television where you see this one doctor who was able to, you know, see something and make sense of it, and I think people are, you know, they see that as a television show, but they would hate that to be their own life situation where they're going through stuff and no one understands it other than that one doctor. But sometimes it does take efforts several times to unveil what truly is the circumstance. And maybe there's a process of how we are able to report to the doctor or report to the professional better. And maybe there's some questions they could ask us as well that would try to get to the heart of what the situation is. But it is a real challenge trying to make sure communication is clear and concise. Susan, in reading some of your bio, there was a situation, a story that you talked about during a period of time that you were a teacher and were having some challenges. Would you mind sharing that with our listeners?
Oh, absolutely. One of the most defining moments of my illness where I really was forced to take a look at it was a manic episode that I had in February of 2003. Several years prior to that, I found myself single with two children with really no skills to get any kind of decent job. And I went back to school. I took four classes, and my student taught, and I got my teaching certificate. And in this area, it's rather difficult to get a teaching job, but I was fortunate enough the following year to be given a maternity leave position from November to March. The following year, I was given a contract. 3 years later, I was given what's called tenure, if you're familiar with teaching. Basically, if you're given tenure, it takes a major infraction for them to fire you. It basically meant that I had job stability and financial stability for the rest of my life until I retired. That was in November. 3 months later, I got sick. I went into a manic episode, and I quit my job. And I walked out on 25 first graders in the middle of the school year. I went to see my doctor the week after I did this, instead of the week before, and she said to me, had you been in my office, I would have had you out on medical disability. But at the time, I was not in a consistent relationship with my counselor. I was not in a consistent relationship with my psychiatrist, and I didn't understand my disease the way that I do today. I just thought I was overwhelmed. I know what the feeling was when I quit my job. The feeling was, I am completely overwhelmed. My job is an hour away from my children. My children are young. It was too much. I couldn't handle it, and I needed a way out. And I had convinced myself that I was going to start a business, which is one of the things that people with bipolar do. We don't see the obvious risks in our choices, and we tend to behave in very impulsive manners. And I did this without checking with anybody.
And you mentioned in your bio about the impact it had on your children, at least one of your sons.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when I talk about how we say we're never going to do what our parents did. In some ways, I did do that to my children. They lived with a lot of financial insecurity and fear. My son took the brunt of that. There were periods of time when we weren't sure where we were going to live, where the money was coming from, and I didn't do a very good job of protecting him from those issues. And when I quit my job, he was very angry at me. He was in sixth grade, and he thought we're going to go back to living the way we were living, not having any money. We had our car repossessed. And, you know, during the time, I would play that out as being a victim. And today I can tell you these things happened in my life because of my inability to make choices that needed to be made. So his fear immediately came up. I would imagine that when I got the job and I was teaching consistently, he was probably feeling safer. And then when I did this, you know, he thought for sure we were going back to the way it was.
And how do you recover from that as a person recognizes you've made some mistakes and decisions could have been different? Are you given a second chance? Or in this situation, maybe a 9th, 10th, and 11th chance?
Well, fortunately for me, I was given a second chance. Immediately following that, though, I was able to take a year off of work and just kind of catch my breath. But the guilt of that decision, not only how it affected myself and my children, but how it affected those 25 students and that community, was horrendous. And that was something I never thought that I'd get over. But I found myself 3 years later in a work environment that I had been in 10 years earlier. Here it was 10 years later, and I was doing the exact same thing I had been doing before, and I went through a horrible period, feeling like I had wasted my life. What had I done? I threw a hand grenade in my life, and look where I am. And that's what brought me into therapy on a much deeper level. I spent the next 6 months really looking at my illness and trying to understand it. And through that process, I was able to have some empathy for myself and say, you know what, I got sick.
Susan, we're going to get ready for our break. Pick up with that comment.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in your brain inspired really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
And we're back. Bob from Scranton, you're on the air.
Hi, Ted.
Love the show. Long-time listener. First-time caller.
Thanks, Bob. Is there a special someone out there you'd like to talk about?
There is, Ted. I recently lost a very big part of my life.
You'd been together a long time?
Since college. This is for my belly, my paunch, my spare tire. I know we had some good times. God knows I'll never forget that night in Albuquerque with the burritos.
It's never easy to lose something that's been such a huge part of you, Bob. Where'd the magic go?
Well, I'd recently begun taking the stairs more and more instead of the elevator, and then we started seeing less and less of each other. One day, it was just gone.
Small step number 67. Take the stairs instead of the elevator or escalator. It's just one of the many small steps you can take to help you become a healthier, well, you. Get started at www.smallstep.gov and take a small step to get healthy.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Hyperbike Performance Centers, the extreme motorcycle tuning facility for performance-minded riders. For the most advanced tuning possible, bring your bike in for a diagnostic in their climate-controlled dyno room. Take advantage of their suspension services designed to tweak your bike's suspension till it fits your personal riding needs. All of their performance products are tested in their facility first. Brakes, wheels, alarms, GPS, and more. Hyperbike Performance Centers on Route 40 West, Frederick, or visit hyperbikeperformancecenters.com.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Tuned in to the Navigating Your Life Show with Dr. Nathaniel J. Williams. To participate in our discussion, please call 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to host@navigatingyourlifeshow.net. Now, back to the program.
Well, welcome back. Susan was sharing a story regarding some challenges in her life, but she shares with us that it has a better ending than it did at the beginning. So, Susan, why don't you pick up where you left off regarding your teaching employment?
Yeah, in February 2003, I had gotten sick. I went into a manic episode and I quit my job. I was discussing the guilt that came with that and the regret that came with that. But after I had gone through treatment and found some empathy for myself, I was able to then try to make some changes and get back on my feet and try it again. Unfortunately for me, one of the problems with bipolar 2 is that we have a very difficult time with deadlines. We have a very difficult time with paperwork. And I had not done what I needed to do to be certified in the state of Pennsylvania. I was teaching in New Jersey, and I was sitting in my dining room table one evening with my husband just in tears because I thought, I've just destroyed my life. This is all I know how to do, and I can't do it. And I called Harrisburg the next day. They had changed the requirements for certification in Pennsylvania, and I no longer met those requirements. My grades weren't good enough. But I called Harrisburg, and I explained the situation that I had been teaching and whatnot, and she said to me, you have 6 weeks to get your paperwork in, and you will be grandfathered in.
Wow.
And I did that, and the following year I had a teaching position in Pennsylvania.
Wow, wait.
So for me, personally, that was my way of being able to make amends and go back and do that again and do it well.
And as we spend the last few minutes together, would you mind talking with us, Susan, about what does a person need to do? Before the first break that we needed to embrace the challenge that we have and to seek some help. But are there some steps and some other processes that a person would need to go through as they're contending and trying to get this right and to enjoy what life has to offer rather than being burdened by it?
Well, certainly. If you have a diagnosis of bipolar disorder, bipolar 2 disorder, or any disorder, actually, I think it's very important that you take the time to understand your illness, to really understand what the symptoms of the illness are, because we have no way of knowing if our disease is knocking at the door if we don't even know what it looks like. So that would be my first suggestion. And you do that by maintaining a continual relationship with your psychiatrist and your therapist. The other thing that I strongly believe in is understanding who you are and do your best to create a life that works for you. My therapist has this great line. She says, mood stabilizing behavior. I need to be very aware of what my circle, my comfort zone is. And for some, that zone is very large. But for me, it's small. and I need to know what my triggers are. So acceptance of self, acceptance of what I can and cannot accomplish, understanding what will trigger my illness. I need to make a commitment to take my medication every day, which unfortunately is very difficult for many people. There's weight gain associated with medication. There's stigma associated with medication, the idea I have to do this for the rest of my life, and people will generally take themselves off their meds without any guidance. And the first couple weeks they're feeling fine, and then soon, you know, down the road, they're really suffering.
In your experience, do people have to take the medication for the remainder of their life? Like an illness, as you mentioned earlier, this may be something that is only managed through medication. What is your understanding of that?
I believe if someone's suffering a depression because of a life event, that it does not need to be a lifelong process. Once the stress or the depression is lifted through either talk therapy or a brief period with an intervention, they no longer need to do that. But if you were like me and you do have a mental illness, personally, yes, I will be taking my medication for the rest of my life because, unfortunately, bipolar is a progressive disease, and it can escalate from bipolar 2 to bipolar 1. If the symptoms are not treated.
And what are some of the concerns that people have in taking medications for the rest of their life? You mentioned stigma. You mentioned the weight gain. But other than that, are there any other reasons? Not that those are not significant reasons, but what are some of the other reasons why a person may be daunted by that as a prospect?
I think sometimes there's some pride and ego involved in that. I think that people feel that they should be able to handle this. And they have a hard time accepting the fact that they are sick. And so they'll start to feel better. Once the medication kicks in, they'll start to feel better and they'll forget how they got to feel better and they'll stop. So it's a difficult process. And then also too, if the people around you are not in support of what you're doing, I know in being duly diagnosed, you may come up against some negativity in the recovery movement. There are those who believe that you do not take any medication. You do not put any substances in your body. And if that's what your support system is telling you, you're very hard-pressed to stand up for yourself and do what you need to do.
So if you're a family member or a person who cares about another person who may have some of these challenges, and maybe it's gone unrecognized, but in listening to today's show, you know, some of the things that you highlighted are beginning to make sense. How do you support someone who may be going through this as a process? We have 3 minutes before our show wraps up, but I wanted to, you know, ask the question as to what do you do if you want to help and not let a person continue in an existence that may not be reaching their fullest potential?
The best thing that someone can do for me if I'm starting to get sick or I'm starting to believe the negativity that my head is telling me is to remind me that this is my illness speaking to me. This is not reality, and that it'll pass. And help me to make decisions that will keep me safe and keep me stable. So if I have a family member, or if there's a family member, and they're watching somebody else start to get sick, is to be gentle with them and sit down and say, remember when this happened last time? Do you remember what it was? And, you know, work together and have a discussion, a dialogue when they're well. Let's make a plan for if you start to get sick again. What can we do? Talk about it. Let the person who's suffering tell you what they need. And then you can sit and say, we agreed on this, and I can see it starting to happen again, and I'm worried. And help them to make choices to promote stability in their life and support them in those choices.
Would you agree that one of the greatest challenges is that sense of isolation that a person may feel or may be actually placed in as they're dealing with this challenge?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I still have people who will come up to me and say, you know, want to talk to me about the illness or that they've just been diagnosed, and they pull me to the side to talk to me. They don't want people to know. And you know, it's sad because people are suffering.
One of the things that I'm writing in a book at this particular point is talking about the isms. And we know the common ones, sexism and racism. But I also think that there are other isms that are also part of the problem. One, the I in ism stands for isolation. The second thing stands for segregation. And the last thing stands for manipulation. And I think especially in hearing what you had to say, Susan, we want to stay away from all three of those things. We want to embrace this issue as a real issue and not hide behind any of those behaviors. And So with that said, Susan, I want to thank you so very much for joining us today and educating us further about the bipolar 2 disorder and giving us some things to think about in our own lives, but also for those individuals who may be affected by this challenge. And I just want to repeat Susan's website, which is www.thenyoustand.org. And there's a way on there for her to be contacted. There's a tab that you can hit, and that would direct you to her. She's giving a fair amount of speaking and engagements, and so if that's something she could do, I know she'd love to be able to do it. So, Susan, I want to thank you and tell you that I sincerely appreciate all you're doing and all you will do.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to,
sure,
to get the dialogue going.
Wonderful. And for our listeners, I hope that you have an enjoyable week, and you'll be back with us next week. We'll continue this conversation about the best ways to navigate your life and to reach your fullest potential. This is your host, Dr. Nathaniel J. Williams.
Thank you again for listening to the Navigating Your Life Show. Please join Dr. Nathaniel J. Williams again next Monday at 7 a.m. Pacific Time, 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Have a great week, and here's hoping your life will change for the better forever.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.